KPCW News Time, now 8:16. Good morning, I'm Leslie Thatcher. Well, Real Women Runs is a collaborative, nonpartisan organization that recruits and trains women nationwide to get more women involved in politics. On the phone with details, I have Morgan Lyon-Cotty. She's the state program manager at the Hinckley Institute of Politics. She has a PhD in political science from George Washington University. She's worked in politics and public policy for 15 years. Thanks for joining us, Morgan.
Happy to.
So this Real Women Runs is a, tell us about it. It's kind of the Utah chapter of Run Women Run?
It's actually its own entity. It's a bipartisan, actually a nonpartisan collaboration of women whose mission is to recruit and then to train other women to successfully run for office.
Okay, so how are you involved in it?
I'm on the board, and Hinckley was one of the Hinckley Institute of Politics was one of the founding members of Real Women Run, and it's just a wonderful organization to be a part of and see women who are already in office serving as mentors and recruiters to try to get more women involved.
Yeah. So this was founded about 5 years ago?
Yeah, it's pretty new, and it was really this organic collaboration of women. You can hear them joke sometimes about how they were just sitting down over some drinks and talking about, how do we fix this? Because Utah does have this amazing history of involvement of women in politics. We are the first state in the nation that elected a state senator. We're the first place where women actually voted. We didn't grant the vote first. That was Wyoming's pride, but our elections were before them, so we get the claim to fame that we voted first. And the numbers of women in running for office or even elected to the state legislature was increasing all through the 90s, and then it peaked in the early 2000s, and it's really dropped off in the state. So that's why these women got together to think about what actions can we do to remedy the situation.
Yeah, so I mean, off to a good start, but the tapering off, how come?
You know, it's really interesting. There's been several studies, and no one has really found what the primary component was. But in general, it's hard to get women involved. Women feel like they have to overcome a few more barriers. They feel like they have to be overqualified before they'll jump in. And one thing that's difficult here in Utah that Real Women Run and others try to let women see is that your life doesn't necessarily have to be in silos. You know, you can be a stay-at-home mom and you can run for office, or you can run for office even if you're, you know, a busy professional. So many of these positions, are part-time, and you can mix it into your life.
Yeah, so what kind of response have you seen then in the last 5 years?
It's been great. We've seen a lot of women come to our trainings. We have a couple of trainings every year. Our biggest one is coming up in January. Our winter training is January 14th of next year. And then we always have a spring training, too. And these are really actually important every year, but also in those odd-numbered years, because I know we have so much focus, especially with the recent presidential election. We focus on those generals and, to a lesser degree, on the midterm elections. But women are actually more likely to get involved in municipal races. They maybe feel more comfortable running for a city spot or a board on a local school board, And so those are the elections that will be coming up in 2017. And we're really excited. We've seen a lot of response since the election. I know a lot of people were focused on whether or not Hillary Clinton would break that highest and hardest glass ceiling, but sometimes you just need to see a woman in a competitive election to be inspired to run, and it certainly was a competitive election.
Yeah. So what kind of training do you provide? I mean, it sounds like it's a day-long deal.
Right. We have the big January training is a day-long, and then we do a half-day-long training in the spring. And it's everything from just trying to get a little more information. We have panels talking about how to make this work with your family, how to make it work with your job. And then there's really specific things on how to raise money, how to create your messaging campaign, even down to where are the best spots to put in lawn signs or the best way to create mailers. So it's really practical training.
Yeah, where does this happen?
It will be at the Salt Lake Community College Miller campus, so right off of I-15 in Sandy, Utah. You can learn more at realwomenrun.com here in and that's our local website. And we just encourage everyone to register and to come and see what it's all about.
Yeah. Now, do you have to be a member to be part of the training? And if so, what's the membership cost?
You do not have to be a member, and I want to correct myself. It's actually realwomenrun.org. You don't have to be a member. You can just go to the website. You can sign up for the emails so you can learn about more of our trainings. But it's a relatively small cost usually, and a lot of our events are actually free.
Yeah. So as you try to recruit women, I mean, where do you find them? Where do you look for them?
A lot of it is through the trainings. We'll have women. We also have socials. We'll have women show up for a social, and they'll learn more about it. A lot of it, though, is person-to-person recruiting. And even here in Utah, we have some professors done at Brigham Young University who've done some research on how important it is to recruit women and that they respond to that. And they did an experiment a few years ago where they found that when the Republican Party in Utah reached out to women to attend caucus meetings or run for precinct positions or even state delegate, they saw an increase in the number of women there. So that's really what we try to encourage. It's really word of mouth, and then also through, obviously, our social media and our other marketing tools.
Yeah, and you mentioned in the local races, city council, school board races, women have been quite successful there. But in terms of the state offices, the legislative seats, I mean, is it tough to get a woman elected outside of the Democratic centers of, say, Summit and Salt Lake counties?
It is. In fact, almost all of our female legislators are from Salt Lake County. We do have one that was just elected. From rural Utah, but that has been an interesting thing to watch. And honestly, it's hard for a Democrat to get elected out of Salt Lake or Summit. And that's honestly part of the story. Women are more likely to be Democrats, and they're more likely to run for office as a Democrat. So in Utah, if you look at the proportion of female Democrats within that party, they're doing really well. But we have a supermajority of Republicans. And when we only have two or three Republicans in the legislature, it makes it really hard for the numbers to increase overall.
Okay. Anything else that our listeners should know?
That's it. Just feel free to go to realwomenrun.org and learn more about our trainings and how to get involved.
Okay. Morgan, thanks for your time this morning.
Thank you.
Morgan Lyon County, the state program manager at the Hinckley Institute of Politics, also a board member of Real Women Runs. You're listening to the Local News Hour here on KPCW. It's 8:28 now. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. This is the KPCW Local News Hour. Good news is that the accident on I-80 has been cleaned up to the extent that traffic is now flowing on I-80. Earlier this morning, a semi-truck overturned, spilling all of its contents out there and basically blocking all three lanes of the highway. Traffic was being diverted off the highway there at Lamb's Canyon and then being pulled back on, creating long delays. Looks like things are now moving smoothly. Well, as we've been reporting, Summit County has filed a petition to intervene before the Public Service Commission to protest Rocky Mountain Power's request to change the rate structure associated with net metering customers who have rooftop solar systems. On the phone to explain is Summit County Council Chairman Roger Armstrong. Good morning, Raj.
Good morning, Leslie. How are you?
I'm doing well, thank you. So why did the council decide to intervene?
Well, you know, we're concerned about sustainability. Solar has been one of our linchpins for achieving our sustainability goals. For a couple of years, we worked with Alpenglow on the community solar program. We've worked with Rocky Mountain Power in terms of their rollout of the subscriber solar program. We see rooftop solar as one of the key elements of a good sustainability plan for a community. And we're concerned that these new rate structures could inhibit people putting solar power on their roofs.
Yeah, it sounds like based on some of the figures that you guys provided in your petition that it would basically cut it in half. So really not much of a savings then, huh?
Yeah, and I think this is the, you know, second part of a double blow that rooftop solar has received. Last year, as you remember, Senate Bill 51 was in the legislature. It failed during the first vote. Legislators went to dinner. Somebody had a conversation with them, apparently, and they came back and approved it. And that eliminated the solar incentives in the state as of the end of December this year. So that was the first part of it. This, you know, reduces the amount that the utility pays for the power that's generated on rooftops. It adds a demand charge, which may be difficult for people to calculate, but it could be very substantial. It could be up to $20 a month. There's an additional application fee, and there's some other elements that really do put a pretty good ding in rooftop solar. Similar programs were proposed in Arizona and Nevada, and the result in Nevada was that three of the largest rooftop solar providers decided to leave the marketplace because it just didn't make sense anymore. And in Arizona, they're still trying to figure out what it all means and trying to assign what the community value of solar is there. So they're still trying to work through that. We see this as, you know, potentially a continuation of those kinds of practices.
Yeah. Now, playing devil's advocate, though, Rocky Mountain Power is arguing that it's losing more than $6 million a year from rooftop or solar rooftop customers, and that could grow to as much as $78 million a year if the rate isn't addressed. They say it's a fairness issue. I mean, you don't agree with that?
I don't know if I agree or disagree. I mean, there may be a need for some additional fees for the utilities. That's possible, but I think, you know, the concern is, I don't know that I have developed an opinion on where this is yet. That's why we need time to take a look at it. But I think that this is probably reaching a little bit further. The Brookings Institute did a fairly thorough study of rooftop solar and the benefits that it actually provides the community. And I'm not sure that utilities generally, not just folks in Rocky Mountain Power, but in the jurisdictions where they're seeking to put these kinds of tariffs in place, I'm not sure that they're truly examining the community benefits.
All right. At the same time, though, it's really an issue of whether or not we subsidize solar rooftop solar panels. And I guess and that's okay with you, that that's something that's worthy of subsidization.
So are you talking about the community or the other ratepayers subsidizing it?
Yeah, the other ratepayers.
I think that's certainly the argument of the utilities. And as I said, I'm not sure that that's borne out entirely. You know, there are other, we have cleaner air. There are other community benefits every time somebody puts solar panels on their roof that doesn't just go to the rate. So, you know, to some degree, the community gets a benefit every time somebody invests in that, that the community doesn't pay for. So again, Brookings Institute, big study, they found that there are other community benefits that aren't being taken into account. We also have to consider that, you know, I don't think it's talked about very much, but we know that our electrical grid creates a security concern. You know, Russia tapped into the Ukraine's grid and knocked out power for 700,000 customers for quite a period of time. And as we start to get away from the absolute tie to the grid, there's some benefits there. And again, I'm not sure that people have really looked at all of the community benefits. And without taking anything away from Rocky Mountain Power, I think that it's a fair conversation to have to see whether ratepayers are over-subsidizing others. But 30 days to go through a 400-page filing and figure out whether these numbers are the correct numbers, I think, is a bit ambitious.
Yeah. So what do we know, though? Those who are part of the Mountain Town Community Solar Program this year, will they be impacted? Or if they still haven't had their solar installed and they don't get net metering done until the end of December, they could be liable for these additional rate changes.
Yeah, the devil's in the details. Existing solar users will not be impacted. The question is, at what point are you vested and considered an existing solar user? Is it when you're under contract to have the solar installed? Is it when the net meter is installed? I don't know the answer to that right now.
All right. So when does this get heard? I mean, it sounds like, I mean, basically this petition is very much in the form of a lawsuit.
Yeah, the Rocky Mountain Power asked the Public Utilities Commission to make a decision by, I believe, December 10th. And what they're asking is that they be allowed to roll out these new rates on sort of a test basis to see how they go, and then they'll revisit the issue later. I think Summit County is certainly not the only entity that's intervened at this point. And I think, you know, the request is going to be to delay the granting of any of this until we have the chance to really study it and pull together our own information and counter it. So that's where we are. In terms of the specifics of the petition itself, that's probably better answered by Dave Thomas, who filed the petition on behalf of the county.
Yeah. Any idea what this cost the county, though, again, because it's taking staff time, you know, I mean, to file this? And again, it's basically a lawsuit.
Yeah, it is. I mean, well, I suppose it is. It's, you know, proceeding before the PUC, and the interested parties certainly have the right to intervene and make their arguments. I mean, the initial investment is not substantial. Dave Thomas turned this around remarkably quickly. We had a conversation about it during council on Wednesday afternoon, and he had this filed the next day. So it's, you know, not a matter of hundreds of hours going into it. We'll see how it goes on a going forward basis. And again, I think we'll be standing shoulder to shoulder with other communities and entities like Utah Clean Energy and HEAL Utah and others that will be involved in this.
Okay. And again, we do know that those who have rooftop installed and net metering in place, they will not be affected by this?
Currently. That doesn't, you know, certainly doesn't inhibit Rocky Mountain Power from coming back at a later time and seeking to change the rate structure with regard to those customers, but they've not indicated that they're not doing it. In this case, it's only on a prospective basis.
Yeah. I haven't seen the numbers, but between Summit County, Park City, and Deer Valley, it seems like we may have purchased a bunch of the Rocky Mountain Power Solar Subscriber Program, and I guess that just wasn't enough to leave Summit County alone, huh?
No, I think, you know, Rocky Mountain Power, to commend Rocky Mountain Power, and again, I don't want to poke them in the eye for the good things that they've done, and I think Subscriber Solar is one of the good things that they've done. They sold it out. They've indicated that they're going to buy another, I think, 20 meg or build another facility, whether they purchase it or build it. So they're moving in that direction, and the cost of solar energy has come down so much now. It's cheaper than coal, and, you know, I've had conversations with Rocky Mountain Power, and they acknowledge that it's becoming more economically feasible for them to enter into this business. I think, you know, the ability, anything that affects the ability of individuals to be able to take some control over their energy use is troubling to me. So that's why we're into this.
Okay. You're off to a budget meeting with Summit County Council?
Yeah, if you want to have a good time, come join us.
Okay. Any idea what you guys are taking on today?
I don't remember which departments we're seeing today. We have four or five departments proposing their budgets to us today and telling us about what they've done and what they intend to do next year. It's a remarkably informative process. I mean, it's our opportunity to meet with, at the staff level, the people that are actually doing all the great work in the county. They tell us, you know, what they've accomplished for this year and what they hope to do next year and show us their budgets, and it's a great opportunity for us to touch base with them, so it's worthwhile.
Okay. Roger, thank you.
Thanks, Leslie. Take care.
Summit County Council Member Roger Armstrong. You're listening to the Local News Hour here on KPCW. KPCW News Time now, 8:43. Good morning. Well, the Alpine World Cup season underway, and that means the return of our weekly updates with Tom Kelly with the U.S. Ski and Snowboard Association. He joins me now on the phone. Good morning, Tom.
Well, good morning, Leslie, and I'm back here in Wisconsin. How is winter starting to look in Park City?
Oh, it's spitting snow. It was rain this morning, but boy, overnight lows, though, into the mid-20s. Maybe we can get some more snow on the ground.
Well, we'll hope so, and that's same case, I think, across all the ski areas getting ready for the World Cup season. This is that time where we're always, like, watching those temperatures and making sure it's getting cold enough to make snow.
Okay. So let's see. Killington World Cup. This is exciting news this weekend. Killington, I don't believe, has hosted a World Cup in some time.
Now, it's the first time actually in Killington, and actually the first time in 25 years in the East. The last time we were in the East was in March of 1991 at Waterville Valley, so it will be a first-time event coming up at Killington.
Okay, and this, again, is a powder core resort. Just given their, their experience here in Park City, decided to bring it to Killington?
Yeah, that's exactly correct, Leslie. And when we've been looking to move the World Cup to the East for some years and just looking for that opportunity, we got that opportunity this year when our traditional Aspen date for the women moved to March as a part of the World Cup final. So we had an opportunity to take a Women's World Cup to the East. We've been working with the International Ski Federation for almost the last 10 years looking for this opportunity. We looked at a number of sites over the last 4 or 5 years, and the one that really stood out was Killington. And as you said, one of the reasons that we really stood behind Killington was the fact that it was a powder corp site. We knew that John Cumming and his company, Hervig Dempster and others, knew what to do to put on a great high-level World Cup competition. They had a great track record of making snow earlier in the season, and the resources that they have dedicated to it, the snowmaking that's been going on there over the last 2 to 3 weeks has been absolutely phenomenal. And we have a great course there. They had a little bit of warm weather over the weekend, but it's getting colder, and they actually have quite a bit of snow in the forecast for this week. So we're feeling pretty good about putting on a world-class event for the international ski racing community this weekend. And I can't even begin to tell you the level of excitement there is back at Killington. We have 6 regional television stations who are all coming on site to do live broadcasts. We've never had that before. So all the excitement that we were looking for, we're seeing that at Killington. Sold out reserve seating in the bleachers. It's going to be a great, great event this Saturday and Sunday.
Yeah, never easy this early in the season, though, to get snow on the ground. So I guess they just lucked out, huh?
Well, it's a combination. Certainly luck plays a role. There's no question about that. But also there's a track record of skill involved and also the infrastructure. They have the water. They have the guns. They have the knowledge. In particular, Hervig Dempster, an Austrian, was a former coach of the U.S. Women's Alpine Ski Team, is chief operating officer for Powder, and he's been embedded back there at Killington. He's one of the most knowledgeable people on World Cup ski racing in the world. So his expertise and that combined with the talent and the infrastructure and the facilities they have at Killington has allowed us to build a race course. And the world's coming there. A lot of the world's training in Colorado right now. We've actually had decent conditions for training at Copper Mountain, another Powder Corp resort. And we're going to be heading east over the next few days, and teams congregating on Thanksgiving Day and racing on Saturday and Sunday, and folks will be able to watch it on NBC and NBCSN. The airtime on that is going to be 1 o'clock Park City time for the second run, both Saturday and Sunday.
Okay, and who to look for? We've got two U.S. women or more than that?
We've got more of a host of U.S. women, but on the top tier, Michaela Schifrin will be the favorite in both events, the GS on Saturday and also the slalom on Sunday. In the slalom, also look for Racy Stiegler to be a factor from the USA, and also Lila Lapagna, who's in her second full year on the World Cup. She had some good performances last year. And then we'll have a host of development skiers, both in the GS and the slalom. You know, I just want to also harken back to a day back 25 years ago at Waterville Valley. I was just talking to her yesterday. Julie Parisian, just 19 years old, was the winner of that event in the Giant Slalom at Waterville. And, you know, just talking to her yesterday and thinking about some of the comparisons to Michaela Schifrin, both of them 19 years old when they started winning on the World Cup Tour. And hopefully Julie's going to be over there to watch. She was the winner 25 years ago, last time we were in the East.
Wow. Okay, lack of snow has canceled the races for the men's speed schedule. Are they going to be made up?
Yeah, you know, this is just very, very weird to be sitting here and thinking that we canceled a race in Colorado, but we're going to a race in Vermont, actually a week earlier than that. But sadly, we did have to cancel the Beaver Creek Birds of Prey races coming up on the schedule for next week. That was a men's downhill Super G and giant slalom. Good opportunities for Stephen Nyman in the downhill and Ted Ligety in the GS, but they just did not have the snowmaking temperatures to do it. Those races now have officially been moved to Val d'Isère, France, so the teams are going to be heading out there shortly. They'll be running the same complement, downhill Super G and giant slalom, on pretty much the same schedule that was originally planned at Beaver Creek. I should note, too, that the men's races in Lake Louise, scheduled for this weekend, have also been canceled. Those have not been rescheduled yet. The women's downhill and Super G schedule for Lake Louise for next week, actually two downhills and a Super G, those are still on the schedule. They delayed the snow control date on that, and we're optimistic the women will be able to go up there. And that's important to us because Michaela Schifrin is going to be getting into the speed action again. She had a good Super G result up there last year, and she may even try the downhill up there. Lindsey Vonn, unfortunately, broke her arm about a week ago in training. She's going to be sitting out for an undetermined amount of time, but she will not be in the starting lineup next week in Lake Louise.
Okay. We've got the Nordic teams, though, opening their season in Finland.
Yeah, we've got a big weekend coming up. The Nordic teams, the men's ski jumping, Nordic combined, and also cross-country men and women will be opening up in Ruka near Kuusamo, Finland, up in the frozen north of Lapland. We're expecting some good races up there on the cross-country side. It's classic racing, which is not necessarily our forte, but we'll see how that goes, a sprint race and a mid-distance race coming up on the weekend. Nordic combined with a pair of events, so we'll be watching for the Fletcher brothers and others in that. And then men's ski jumping this weekend and a good group for the USA there. Women's ski jumping opens up the following week in Lillehammer. Sarah Hendrickson looking to make her return to action there. And we also have coming up over in Pyeongchang on the Olympic venue, we have a snowboarding big air competition. Actually had one in Milan a week ago. Pretty good for the USA, but with Haley Langland finishing in second place on the women's side. But this is the newest Olympic event. They've built a towering scaffold in Pyeongchang, right at the same location as the Nordic ski jump. They kind of face each other. So the men will be going at it this weekend in another very important FIS World Cup big air event, big air making its debut in Pyeongchang coming up in February of 2018.
Okay. And again, there was a world press briefing there a couple of weeks ago. Things looking good?
Yeah, it was pretty interesting. I had an opportunity to go over to Pyeongchang about 10 days ago for the World Press Briefing, a gathering of around 250 media and operational personnel from around the world. Had a chance to see all of the venues. I had been there one other time, so it was interesting to see the progress that they've made. One of the things that we've liked about the Pyeongchang Olympics and even going back into the bid phase is two things. One, most of the venues for us were already built. The only venues that needed to be constructed for us was the downhill venue, and that now is complete at Yongsyeon. The men tested that last year. Stephen Nyman on the podium in that event. Great race course located just south of maybe a half hour or 45 minutes from the main centerpiece, Alpensia, of the Olympic Games in Pyeongchang. So that venue is in place. The other thing that we really liked about it is that it will be a very ski-centric Olympics. Usually it's the skating events that are the focal point. Here it's going to be the ski events. So in the Alpensia Resort, we will have the cross-country events, the Nordic combined events, the ski jumping, the slalom and the giant slalom, the bobsled and luge, and all of this taking place in one resort complex where we'll also have the athlete village, the opening and closing ceremony stadium, as well as the medals plaza. So we're pretty excited about that. And then about 30 to 40 minutes away is the Phoenix Park venue. This will be the site of the freestyle, free skiing, and snowboarding events, with the exception of the big air, which will take place in Alpensia. So a very compact Olympics, probably the most compact that we have ever seen, maybe comparable a little bit to what we saw in Lillehammer back in 1994. But quite excited about this. The skating venues are down on the coast, about a 45-minute drive away. All of this will be reachable from Seoul by a high-speed train that will take literally just a little bit over an hour. So we're pretty excited about preparation. Still 540 days to go, so a little bit of time yet, but feeling pretty good about things in Pyeongchang.
Okay, Tom, thanks. Talk to you next week.
Thanks. Talk to you next week.
Tom Kelly with the U.S. Ski and Snowboard Association. KPCW News Time now, 8:54. Good morning, I'm Leslie Thatcher. Well, Park City resident and author Katie Mullally releasing her third volume in the Land of series of children's books. She joins me now in the studio. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie.
So the book's out, ready for purchase, just in time for the holidays.
It is. Got here last week, 2,500 of them. It was a really great workout hauling them from the truck into the storage unit.
Okay. This book is titled The Land of I Am. So what do you touch on in this book?
Well, if you really think about it, two of the most powerful words we can use are I am, because whatever we say that follows those two words shape how we see ourselves. You know, I am tired. I'm so stupid. You know, I feel great. I am wonderful. Whatever it is that you say after I am really does affect how you feel and how you see yourself. And so why not start teaching this idea to kids? Because you just hear so many kids, I'm so dumb, I'm slow, I'm fat, I'm ugly. And that's just going to affect how they see, whether it's true or not, because most of the time they're not, but we're so quick to give ourselves negative labels. And so with this land, like the others, providing a new tool to teach a concept that both kids and adults can really use.
Okay. This is the third of how many?
12 right now, so far, that we've got lined up. Hopefully more. So yeah. We'll just see as they unfold.
Yeah. So you've got the idea for another 9 then.
Yeah? Yes. Yeah. We're going to deal with patience, worry, change, problem solving, being present, gratitude, disappointment, acceptance.
Wow. Okay. And you've got the same illustrator?
Yes. Toby Allen is my amazing illustrator out of the UK. And he has agreed. He has signed on to be with me for all 12.
Great.
And his art is just as important as my words to create an overall experience for the readers.
Yeah. And it's written in a kind of Dr. Seussian
style. Yeah, mm-hmm. That Seussian style. As an adult, when I read to my nieces and nephews, I always prefer to read in a rhyme. It's more fun. It's more entertaining. And learning how to write in rhyme was really challenging. It's almost like a puzzle. It really is a puzzle. And I love the mechanical nature of it, to find the right word, the right rhythm, and be able to condense these important messages into basically 1,200 words.
Wow.
It really challenges my engineering side.
Yeah. So what's your hope for the books?
And I would love to get these really into every hand, the hands of every kid in the country. You know, they're just important messages. However I do that, whether it's through libraries, book fairs, schools, and of course, you know, to sell thousands of them, which is the hope of every author, but really to make an impact. I think nowadays, kids and adults, they're being hammered with so much negative information through the media, through how we interact with each other, that if I can provide simple little tools that can remind everybody of how, you know, what their true labels are, or like with the other two, how to make good choices, inclusion and acceptance. These books are really just to help kids become better people and really make a difference in the world just through their own actions, behaviors, and energy.
Yeah. So you said you had a print of how many?
2,500 this time.
All right. So that doesn't sound like a lot. I mean, when you think about all of the kids that you could potentially reach.
Right. Well, because I've self-published, so it's all me. It's all my, you know, my storage unit, my funding, everything. I'm going with smaller runs at first. And this winter, I'm going to be able to take more time to really focus on getting the distribution out. You know, I've done a pretty good job of hitting the local Park City market, and Park City's been so supportive of my books, the messages, and whenever a new one comes out, people are just contacting me right and left. However, there's a much larger market out there. And so this winter is going to be really focusing on how to hit those library markets, especially the underfunded schools, looking for grants, looking for other opportunities, book fairs, whatever it is, to make sure that these books can get to those who need them. Mm-hmm. And so the first run is small, but we'll be doing more, hopefully.
Yeah. Okay. And then what about getting it on like Amazon?
It is on Amazon.
Oh, okay.
Amazon's an interesting creature to work with. And so trying to work on the nuances of whether or not you have your book on them and they distribute them for you, which is a significant discount that they want, plus they charge you shipping, or you have it where Amazon acts as the shelf space and then people order through you. It's not as cut and dry as you think it would be.
Yeah. But you do have a book signing?
I do have a book signing. I do sell on my own site as well. I get a lot of orders through my own website. Yeah, so I'm doing a book signing at Dolly's on this Saturday, Small Business Saturday, from 6 to 8 p.m.
Okay. Retail cost is what?
$16.99.
Okay. Well, great. Anything else you want to mention?
Nope, that's it. Just wanted to thank Park City for being such a big supporter, especially KPCW. Whenever I've got a new project out, you guys are first to jump on and talk about it.
Well, good. Good luck with it. Thanks.
Thanks, Leslie.
Katie Mullally, KPCW News Time now, 9 o'clock.